dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There truly are a few people that I believe are making a more outsized contribution to the forces of good than our first guest. He is a man I've come to know and admire greatly, proud to consider him a friend, but mostly consider him to be a lodestar in understanding the challenges of our time, particularly as they bear on the nexus between national security and the law. He is a former federal prosecutor who prosecuted successfully the blind sheikh and his co-conspirators who tried to topple the World Trade Center the first time around. These days, he is a massively important contributor to the public policy debate through his columns at National Review and also PJ Media, the author of numerous best-selling books, including my personal favorites, Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad. He is, of course, Andy McCarthy. Andy, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Frank, it's great to be with you.
So much to talk about, where to begin. I guess I'd like to start with the current controversy that you have been helping to illuminate, the question of the president's immigration order, his executive order, and the legal machinations underway at the moment. Would you just sort of level set for us on what you think is at issue here, and specifically the question of whether the president has the authority to execute such an order?
Yeah, the overarching thing that's at issue, Frank, is whether the president can impose a temporary ban on classes of aliens for national security reasons on his own judgment that their entry into our country would be detrimental. And what the statute means by detrimental, it's clear from the, if you look at the statutory scheme that that provision is found in, that we're talking about threats to public health, threats to public safety, national security. So that's what it's about. And I guess the subsidiary question and the more immediate one that we're dealing with now is whether the president's judgment in this regard is subject to judicial review. And if it is subject to judicial review, what are the standards? What are they allowed to review? And how must the administration respond to the concerns of the judiciary?
Hmm. And do you believe that this Judge Robard out in Washington State has overreached by injecting himself as he has? And in particular, Andy, as an accomplished practitioner in the federal courts, that the lack of a legal justification for what he's done is untoward, shall we say?
Yeah, I think, Frank, that he's outrageously overreached. I think it's an unsettled question, although it's one that that the administration should prevail on, whether the court should have any role in this whatsoever. And the reason I say that is in constitutional analysis, not to go all lawyer on everyone, but the president here is acting at the pinnacle of his legal authority, because as the president, he is supreme in foreign relations, and in particular in the duty to repel foreign threats to the homeland, to national security. And he's dealing, therefore, not only with his own reservoir of authority under Article 2 of the Constitution, which creates the presidency. The Constitution also makes the Congress supreme in terms of defining the qualifications for aliens to either enter our country or be present in our country. And in the exercise of that unquestioned authority, they have delegated to the president sweeping power in a very clear and unambiguous statute to, in his judgment, if entry into the country by an alien or a class of aliens would be detrimental to our national security, he is totally within his power to impose a temporary ban. I think it's important to stress here, Frank, that what we're talking about is a temporary measure. It's not the way it's been sort of described in the media as if it was a permanent ban. It's a temporary measure. And he's also allowed to impose whatever other conditions he thinks the national security requires. So in constitutional analysis, not only is the president acting at the very pinnacle of his power because he has all his own power and all the power that Congress can give him in an area where Congress has unquestioned authority, there's a lot of law to the effect that in this particular kind of area of national security, namely foreign threats to the homeland and to national security, the courts don't have any role whatsoever. Or as Justice Jackson put it in the World War II era, in our system, decisions of this kind are supposed to be made by the political branches who are accountable to the people whose lives are at stake, not unelected, unaccountable lawyers who have no expertise in national security matters. So pretty apparent to me that Judge Robart overstepped, and I would say even more extreme in that since the president's role here is very clear and very legitimate, and the court's role here is very questionable, I would have thought that a modest, restrained judge would say, I have a lot of questions about this. Let's have a hearing, a big hearing on this preliminary injunction. But the president's order should remain in effect until I decide otherwise. Instead, he's turned the presumption on its head.
Andy, you have, as often is the case, broken new ground, I think, by coining a term which it seems to me is exactly right in terms of the kind of vetting the president is trying to do. That is to say, to protect us in a very literal sense from enemies, foreign, and for that matter, I suppose, domestic too, but certainly for the moment in this context, foreign, who are, as you call it, Sharia supremacists. There is another statute on the books, and as you know, some of the plaintiffs in these proceedings are citing it, 1965 prohibition on, quote, discrimination, unquote, in immigration decisions. What is your view of the latitude the president has to say, we are not going to let in people who don't share our values, who seek to subvert our Constitution, who believe that their doctrine, their ideology, their law, Sharia, must supplant ours? Does he have that authority as well, in your judgment?
Frank, I think you've really hit on the core question, because let's dispense with the 65 Act immediately. It says that you can't have a framework of immigration that's based on racial animus or prejudice based on national origin and the like. It doesn't say anything about religion. So the 65 Act really doesn't touch religion, but we should cut to the chase on religion because that's what it's all about. The reason I stress Sharia supremacism is because I don't think Sharia supremacism is religion. And this is really the key question that has to be won. If you look at the act that the provision Trump is relying on is in, it talks about not only keeping out the kinds of threats he's identified, it also talks about, for example, the Communist Party and totalitarian ideologies and other ideologies that talk about basically overthrowing the American system. I think Sharia supremacism is a political totalitarian ideology in a religious veneer, and that it's in the interest not only of American national security, but frankly, of authentically spiritual, religious, moderate Muslims, that we separate the Sharia supremacists who don't really have a religion agenda. They have a totalitarian political agenda. And say that this is not religion and we are entitled to keep this out of our country and we don't want to see our country turn into what's happened in Europe. But we are absolutely open to having, you know, Muslims in the United States who revere the Constitution and don't want to turn our country into a totalitarian Sharia-based society. And yeah, I think we're totally entitled to do that.
I think you're right. Not only entitled to, but we have no choice but to do it. Andy McCarthy, this is a perfect segue to the next topic, which is, should the Muslim Brotherhood be designated a terrorist organization? But alas, we are out of time, so we're going to hopefully get you back on shortly to discuss that very important sort of next application of this principle that we must be protected against Sharia supremacism, as in the past we understood we had to be protected against the communists and the Nazis and fascists and so on. But thank you so much for your time today, my friend. I am so grateful to you for it and for all the incredible work you do at National Review Online and PJ Media and so many other outlets. Do come back to us again very soon. Trevor Loudon joins us. We'll talk about the possibilities of Sharia supremacists penetrating and actually operating against members of Congress. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. One of my all-time favorite guests is Trevor Loudon, a man that has broken really extraordinary new ground in recent years in documenting a problem that every member of Congress, every senator, every elected and appointed official, for that matter, on up to the President of the United States, swears an oath to contend with, namely enemies, foreign and domestic. As we were talking about with Andy McCarthy, there's some of both, to be sure, but Trevor's work, particularly on the enemies within, the title of a terrific movie, a documentary that he's produced, and very much the focus of a new, shorter video entitled America Under Siege, A Civil War, 2017, is all the perfect backdrop for a conversation that I'm anxious to have with him about a problem on Capitol Hill at the moment. Trevor Loudon, back from New Zealand, your native land, welcome. Good to have you in America, and great to have you on Secure Freedom Radio.
Oh, look, excellent, Frank. Always a pleasure to be on. Thank you very much for having me.
Let me ask you first and foremost about this saga on Capitol Hill. It's very much an unfolding story, but what can you tell us briefly about what we know of an evident problem with IT professionals in the House of Representatives?
Yeah, well, we've got three brothers, Muslim brothers, I believe they're Pakistani, who've been working for some very important Democrats on IT. And supposedly they were suspended from their job for inappropriately accessing information. But we also hear stories that they're still working for some other members of Congress,
including Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, who had a few IT problems, as I recall. So, Trevor, finish your thoughts on what this story suggests has been going on Capitol Hill.
Well, the implication to me is very clear. As most of the congressmen and women that this group has been working for are connected to the Foreign Affairs Committee or the Homeland Security Committee or the Intelligence Committee or the Armed Services Committee. Like, you've got Joaquin Castro, who's on the Armed Services Committee, for instance. You've got Andre Carson, who is on the Intelligence Committee. Joaquin Castro is also on the Intelligence Committee, by the way. Andre Carson never should, you know, both of these people are problematic in their own right. But they have to have someone, to have a group of Muslims doing their IT, and now these people being accused of inappropriately accessing information.
Well, and stealing equipment, too, as I understand it. I mean, there's a criminal investigation underway about these guys, according to press reports.
Well, one of these guys has a bankruptcy in his background and a criminal conviction. So, you know, how did these pass any form of security clearance? Well, the answer is, I believe there are no security clearances anymore in Congress.
Well, certainly no more background checks, at least for these folks. I'm told, Trevor, that, and we'll be talking more about this, I know, with Fred Flights here shortly, but the Intelligence Committee and its communications and the personnel supporting its intelligence information technology are, you know, vetted and closely held and so on. But that does not seem to be the case with the correspondence and the other information that would pass through members' offices. And without knowing all of the particulars, Trevor, would you say that it's a distinct possibility that there may be information in those channels that would be sensitive, or at least that you wouldn't want in unfriendly hands?
Well, exactly. You know, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And okay, they have tapped into a link on the information chain. So who knows what could have been stolen here? Who knows what information has been accessed? And it may not be the most sensitive information, but we know that in the intelligence game, every bit of information applied in context can fill in a picture, can fill in a jigsaw puzzle for the enemy.
We'll be talking more about that with an intelligence professional in the United States Army, now a member of Congress, Lee Zeldin, in the next segment. But let me quickly turn to sort of the larger tableau you've been painting now, both in your books, Trevor Loudon, Barack Obama and the Enemies Within, and another, The Enemies Within, Communists, Socialists, and Progressives in the U.S. Congress. It's also, as I said, the subject of two videos that you've produced. Talk about the context of what's been happening here, the nature of the membership, not everyone, obviously, but a substantial part of the Democratic caucus on Capitol Hill these days.
Well, what you've had, especially since 1995, is a concerted effort by the hard left and their Muslim Brotherhood allies, and these two factions massively overlap, to infiltrate into Congress a whole bunch of people sympathetic to their aims and to get them onto committees like Homeland Security, Intelligence, Judiciary Committee overseeing the FBI, and other very sensitive bodies. So we say there's at least 100 members of your House, including several involved in this scandal, and 20 members of the Senate who are so compromised by their contacts with neo-communist groups or Muslim Brotherhood groups or both that they couldn't pass a basic FBI background check to be a realtor or sell you stamps at the post office or drive a school bus. But they're serving on the Armed Services Committee, the Homeland Security Committee, the Intelligence Committee, three of the key committees that these Pakistani brothers have been actively working with. And so that, you know, Americans who trust their national security, they trust the security of Congress, are just being betrayed. There is no effective security for these people.
Let me ask you, Trevor, we there's so much to say on that score, but let's get down to some specific cases if we can. One of the most important of which is at the moment the case of Keith Ellison, a member of Congress from Minnesota, a man who aspires to be the next chairman of the Democratic National Committee, the leader of the Democratic Party. Tell us about Keith Ellison's background in this regard.
Well, you've got two leading contenders for that position, Tom Perez, and you've got Keith Ellison. Now, Ellison has a long history with the communist movement. He was involved with the Maoist Freedom Road Socialist Organization as a young student. And then he threw in his lot with the old traditional Communist Party USA, who used to supply phone bankers for him. He wrote for their publication. He held meetings in the House, fundraising meetings in the home of the leader of the Minnesota Communist Party. But he is also extensively tied to the Muslim Brotherhood through fronts like CARE and MAS, the Muslim American Society. The Muslim American Society even paid for his pilgrimage to Mecca, his Hajj, back in 2008, where he met with all sorts of key Saudi officials and Muslim officials, you know, some of very dubious connections. Yet this is the man who's got his foot in both the Marxist and the Muslim Brotherhood camp, who's the front runner for the leadership of the DNC.
We'll have to talk about Tom Perez on another occasion. We are hard out of time, Trevor Loudon, but I appreciate so much your expertise, the hard work that you've done documenting each of these charges. Again, I commend to all of you his newest film, especially America Under Siege, A Civil War 2017. You can download it for free. Google it America Under Siege. Trevor, keep up that important work you do, and do come back to us again very soon to talk about, among other things, Tom Perez and the Democratic Party's future. Next up, we will be speaking with Congressman Lee Zeldin of New York about this subject and much more. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's a great pleasure to say, joined by one of our favorite members of the House of Representatives. He is Congressman Lee Zeldin. He represents, with great distinction, the people of the 1st District of New York. He served in the United States Army in a battalion of paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne Division. He is still, I believe, in the Army Reserves, currently serving as a major, and his MOS, as they say in the military, his occupational skill, is military intelligence, which informs a lot of the work that I know he's doing these days on the Committee on Foreign Affairs and the Committee on Financial Services in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman Zeldin, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Happy to be back. Thanks for having me.
I wanted to draw on that experience as a military intelligence officer, Congressman, to ask you about a subject we were just talking about with Trevor Loudon. And I don't know if you have all of the details or would be able to talk much about them if you did have them. But suffice it to say that there is a criminal investigation underway on Capitol Hill involving some number, I've heard 3, 4, 5 individuals, many of whom seem to be related. They appear to be Muslim. That may or may not prove to be the case, but they appear to be. But whatever it is they are, they have been providing sort of collectively services to some, I think, 40 House Democrats, some of them on the Intelligence Committee, like Andre Carson, others on, I believe, your Foreign Affairs Committee. And there is this concern that they have been stealing equipment and perhaps also information. Is there a counterintelligence problem here, do you think, possibly? And should this be a priority for people like your former colleague, Congressman Mike Pompeo, to up our game in that department?
Well, it's important that we are always doing whatever we can to up our game on many different fronts, many different intelligence fronts. This is a concerning investigation that's taking place. I'm happy to see that there is the awareness and the investigation taking place right now. A lot of important communications, personal information from constituents and other data is housed as part of that hardware and that network within Congress. So to know that any of that information is being wrongfully moved out of its place it's supposed to be is something that should be taken very seriously. The cybersecurity threats that we face impact our government, impacts our businesses and our individuals, and that is important. But where there are employees, there are people who are under contract with the House of Representatives, with Congress, they certainly have a duty to be protecting this information and certainly not stealing it. So what we have learned so far, I'm happy to see that we now have that awareness and that investigation taking place. And for our intelligence community, it's just another reminder that we always need to step up our game.
Yeah, I hear you. Let me ask you about another subject on which I'm sure you're as gratified as I am as a very strong supporter of the U.S. relationship with the State of Israel. There's probably been no more marked shift in the new administration's policy approach in the international arena than a very different attitude towards Israel. The president is apparently considering an executive order to cut funding to the Palestinian Authority. Do you think that's advisable?
I believe that funding should be cut to the Palestinian Authority, and I could think of many examples why. And one example, just one alone, is enough of a reason for me to cut off funding, is the way the Palestinian Authority financially rewards terror, not just their murdering of innocent Israelis. They don't just incite violence, they financially reward the terrorists. But in some cases, it's been U.S. service members. Taylor Force was a United States Military Academy graduate who was murdered by one of these terrorists in Israel. And it is repulsive to think that U.S. taxpayer dollars can fund financially rewarding terror against the United States and our allies. That alone is enough of an argument for me to cut off funding.
Yeah. You know, a related issue, and your term incitement is very apt here, Congressman Lee Zeldin, and that is the practice of inciting children in the Palestinian areas to believe that jihad is what they must do, and dying in the way of Allah and all that is their obligation under their faith. It's appalling, as you say, that we might be subsidizing that practice to the detriment, of course, of Israel, but also ourselves in some cases, as you say. Congressman, you've also been a very forceful critic of the Iran deal, and specifically what it has done to enrich and empower and embolden that regime. Talk a little bit, if you would, about the idea of designating the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as a terrorist organization. Would you recommend that to President Trump and believe he should take that step?
Well, it is a matter of fact that the IRGC is financing and supporting terror. I could think of many different examples to back that up. The evidence is very clear, whether it is assisting Hezbollah in Syria, helping the Houthis in Yemen overthrow the government. If you look at Iran, it's basically forming a circle around Saudi Arabia. And, you know, despite the good, bad, and ugly of our relations with Saudi Arabia, you know, you could see what's forming by Iran in many respects, driven by efforts of the IRGC, where, you know, U.S. oil prices, our reliance on what could end up being, you know, if you drove down production in Saudi Arabia, what happens to drive up the price of oil to help Iran and Russia, and where we are right now relying on oil as much as we do. I mean, this is a national security threat for us, and we're going to end up financing even more of Iran's bad activities. So you take what IRGC is doing right now, and I just gave a few examples. You take what the IRGC is doing right now to finance and participate in terror, and you play out the consequences of what they are doing long term, it's going to lead to further propping up the wrong regime and financing even more bad behavior that's adverse to our interests. So it's the short game and the long game here are both adverse to what's in the best interest for America's national security.
Yeah, so designation there makes sense. What about the designation of another group? I believe you have co-sponsored legislation calling for the designation as a terrorist organization of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is apparently also under active consideration by the Trump administration. How high a priority would you assign to that step, Congressman Zeldin?
Well, I think it is important for the United States, where we talk about eliminating threats that exist, and you know, so many people here in our country want to be as politically correct as possible to the point that they aren't even willing to identify the threat. And in order to eliminate a threat, you have to be willing to identify it. And where these threats exist, and we're, you know, we're touching on a couple here right now in this conversation, step number one is to identify, and then you take actions to cut off efforts, especially with those efforts connected to the United States and those, you know, companies and entities and countries doing business and engaging with the United States. What we use, whatever leverage we have, to strengthen our relationships with our friends and treat our adversaries as our adversaries. So identifying the threat, it's kind of shocking that people are just so focused on political correctness to the point that they aren't even willing to identify it.
Yeah, well, this has been true for decades now, I guess, but particularly since 9/11. And this is a moment when corrective action is clearly in order. Congressman, we've got less than a minute left. Do you believe that Donald Trump ought to execute the promise he made to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem?
Yes, absolutely. And it shouldn't even be considered as controversial, and you know, some people are lobbying hard against this move. Listen, Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. It's where the Knesset is. It's where the Israeli president and prime minister live and work. So it's the right policy. It makes sense on many different levels, and I believe strongly that he should follow through.
Good. I hope he will. We'll be talking about it, I know, in the future as well. Thank you so much, Congressman Lee Zeldin, for the great work you do on Capitol Hill, for your service to our country in uniform as well, and for joining us from time to time. I hope you'll do so again very soon. Next up, Fred Flights joins us. We'll talk a bit more about Iran right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's good to welcome once again my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs, a career intelligence professional with time both in the Central Intelligence Agency, also as the Chief of Staff of John Bolton in the State Department, and on the staff of the Select Committee on Intelligence in the House of Representatives. Fred, it's good to have you, as always.
Good to be here, Frank.
We talked a little bit last week about this problem of a seeming counterintelligence fiasco on the Hill involving, by some accounts, as many as 40 members of the Democratic caucus in the House of Representatives. Fred, I know, having worked on the House Intelligence Committee, you're, I gather, somewhat sanguine that they wouldn't have penetrated the official communications of the committee and databases and so on. But give us a sense of what other problems might arise as this investigation unfolds.
Well, Frank, you could expect the news media to run right out and say, well, these guys weren't on the Intelligence Committee staff, so nothing sensitive was revealed. And that would not be the right conclusion to draw. These guys had access to the unclassified emails of Intelligence Committee members, which means they may have had information on calendars, travel, topics of meetings. This is all valuable intelligence, especially the Chinese. The Chinese are known for trying to hack Intelligence Committee members' email accounts. This kind of stuff is very valuable. There could be whistleblowers, foreigners who met with these members. It's very serious. And my concern is that we seem to have individuals here, whether this is an effort by jihadists to penetrate the House or not. These are individuals with serious legal and financial problems. One of them apparently went bankrupt. And I'm just wondering, was there any security investigation of these people before they were given access to the computers of members of the House of Representatives? I mean, this is a major scandal.
Yeah, I think so, too. And we'll know more about it, needless to say. But it does seem as though, especially against the backdrop of some of the problematic backgrounds, if you will, of some of the members themselves, on top of what these characters may have been up to, that a thorough investigation looking not just at the immediate question of, you know, did they steal stuff and did they get into emails, but really a damage assessment is in order. Fred, let me ask you about another subject that I know you've been giving thought to. We've talked about it a lot lately. This executive order of the president on trying to exclude people he believes pose a security threat to the United States, having spent a lot of time trying to protect our country in the intelligence business from threats like this. What's your take on what is happening at the moment?
Well, I have an observation that I think is important to make, and I've been arguing this with the liberal media. They kept saying, you know, the Trump administration provided a list, and the list doesn't count. They haven't provided names of any foreigners who were actually engaged in acts of terrorism. Well, let me point out there was an incident listed on this list of a tourist who was beheaded in Algeria in 2014. And Politico tried to argue that we can't jump to conclusions that that was an act of terrorism, because we don't know that that beheading, that ISIS was behind it, or that there was a terrorist intent, or that the person was influenced by ISIS propaganda. Give me a break. This is exactly what President Trump is talking about concerning the media refusing to report these incidents and playing them down when they happen. Every time there's an incident like this, we hear, we're not sure it's terrorism, we're not sure ISIS or radical Islam or jihadists are behind it. And I think it was about time that the Trump administration called this out.
Yeah, I do too. And while there's quibbling about some of the reporting that has been done on some of the more prominent of these incidents in the United States, most especially, there's clearly a failure to connect the proverbial dots. The connective tissue, it seems to me, in virtually all of these is Sharia supremacism. And to be blind to that reality or to quibble about the particulars of does somebody have a ISIS card on them when they decapitate an American tourist is really a disservice to the public. Fred, you have written a lot over the years, including a superb book entitled Obama Bomb, A Dangerous and Growing National Security Fraud. You've also of late written, I think at National Review, about the necessity of having that so-called deal shredded, perhaps when Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in town to see President Trump. Give us the background on why you think that's the right way to deal with this and your sense as to whether that's something that President Trump might actually do.
Well, there's talk right now that the Trump administration is going to strictly enforce the agreement instead of a substantial renegotiation or tearing it up. This would be a serious mistake because it legitimizes an agreement that is frankly a fraud. It does not stop Iran from pursuing nuclear weapons-related technology. And I think it's important to point out that this negotiation, this treaty agreement is not a treaty, was negotiated over Israel's objections and behind its back. It was a betrayal of the state of Israel. And I think the best way to make it up to Israel for that would be for Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump, when Netanyahu visits the White House, to jointly shred the agreement. Maybe we could put a shredding machine on a table in front of the news media and they could feed pages of this agreement into the shredder to demonstrate that this president will not stand behind international agreements that are a fraud and endanger national security.
That's the crux of the matter, is that it is endangering our national security, Fred. And speaking of which, this ballistic missile program that the Iranians continue to pursue, there was another test of one, I believe, in the past 24 hours, has as clearly its purpose delivering to some target, perhaps in Israel, perhaps in Europe, perhaps against American forces in those places or elsewhere in the Middle East, perhaps. And indeed, in due course, if not in quite short order, here in the United States as well. Talk about the kind of behavior, I guess Donald Trump called it the bad behavior that the Iranians have been engaging in.
Well, it's first worth pointing out that when Iran supporters say that these missile launches don't violate a Security Council resolution barring ballistic missile tests, they're right, because this resolution actually says that the missile isn't designed to carry nuclear warheads. It's not a violation. Now, it's absurd that any nation would build missiles that could carry a warhead as far as Iran's. Iran is the only nation in history to have a ballistic missile of 2,000 kilometers or more in range without having a nuclear weapons program. It's just absurd. And weak agreements like this, weak agreements like the nuclear agreement, has emboldened Iran to engage in more belligerent and destabilizing activity. I think the Iranians are testing President Trump right now. After 8 years of weakness and appeasement by Obama, they may not understand that an ultimatum by this administration means something very different than the last administration. And I think there's a possibility we could see military action, possibly to guarantee the freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf.
Fred Flights, as you see it, would that be necessary, but also necessary, a larger effort on the part of the American people, as I talked about with Ken Timmerman on this program earlier in the week, to encourage the people of Iran to see in this new president a very different and supportive attitude towards their efforts to liberate themselves, in contrast to Barack Obama's rather adamant opposition to that idea?
I think that we have to again endorse the position of regime change as the only solution to the threat from Iran. And look, I know that President Trump does not want to go to war with Iran. He doesn't want a war. None of us want a war with Iran. But if missiles are being fired at ships in the Persian Gulf, if our ships are being harassed by Iranian ships, this can't go on. This can't go on. And I think there may have to be a measured military response to let the Iranian government know that we're serious. And I think that will also send a message to the Iranian people. It has to be accompanied by an effort for us to reach out to the Iranian people, and not in the foolish way Obama did of apologizing to Iran for past American policies.
Amen. Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your great work. Next up, we will be speaking with Rowan Scarborough of the Washington Times. We'll talk about the parlous state of Obama's legacy as it relates to the U.S. military. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Rowan Scarborough, one of the best national security reporters in America. He reports at one of my favorite publications, the Washington Times. Rowan is, in addition to being an accomplished journalist, a best-selling author, including of two books, Rumsfeld's War, The Untold Story of America's Anti-Terrorist Commander, and Sabotage, America's Enemies Within the CIA. Rowan Scarborough, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Good to talk to you.
One of the things that I particularly prize about your reporting, Rowan, is you often go where most other national security journalists fear to tread. And in particular, you have done heroic work, really, keeping track of and trying to hold accountable the Obama administration for its efforts to, well, for want of a better term, fundamentally transform the United States military with a series of sort of social experiments or social engineering, if you will. Talk a little bit about that practice and what it has bequeathed to the current president, perhaps by starting with the prism, if you will, of this last parting shot by Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy under President Obama, the so-called diversity roadmap.
That is a report that came out from the Navy a week after Donald Trump was inaugurated as president. So that in itself raised eyebrows that why is this report even issued? I mean, since Trump now runs the Navy, you know, shouldn't they have waited for his Navy secretary, his team to come in to see if they even wanted a report like this written? The diversity roadmap, the way the Navy wrote it, it is much more, much stricter, much more enforcement oriented than the roadmaps issued 2 years ago by the Army and the Air Force. It basically mandates that the Navy is going to look like the world. It has a demographic priority, and it says to commanders there will be a management mechanism which will oversee the decisions you make on who is promoted, who is recruited, all things like this. So it's nearly an order for quotas is what it is, job quotas, in an institution that is not the civil service. It's not a private organization or a corporation. It is a military that is designed to go out and kill people and defend our country. And you want the best to be able to do that. Not everybody is good at going out and being an infantryman or a Delta Force. But this roadmap reads more suited for a civil service organization than it does for the military.
Yeah. Rowan, you know, this approach sort of bespeaks the idea that, as you say, everybody's entitled to serve in the military and that it's really just an equal opportunity employer with no regard for readiness, let alone what you've said has to be its principal mission, and that is winning the nation's wars and, yes, in the process, if need be, killing people. What has been the experience of the Army and the Air Force with these roadmaps they adopted, less draconian perhaps, but they adopted earlier? And more generally, how would you describe the state of morale, the state of readiness, and the capabilities of the military to perform that vital mission?
Well, the vice chiefs of the four branches testified yesterday on the dismal state of military readiness. Less than half of our Army brigades are ready to deploy and fight. Two-thirds of the Navy's F-18 Hornets are not flyable. Can you believe that? Half of the Marine Corps tactical aircraft is not flyable. I mean, what commander-in-chief would want to leave that as his legacy, that as he went out the door, the naval air forces that you rely on so much around the world are becoming dysfunctional? But this is, I'm sorry to say, this is President Obama's legacy. He, I think, is going to be known more for social transformation of the military women in combat, open gays, transgenders, inclusion, diversity, then he will be known fondly for keeping the military ready and ready to fight. And I'm afraid that that is his legacy. Now, you just look at the Thunderbirds, the performance unit of the Air Force. The last round of applicants, according to the commander, were two white and two male. And so he sent back a memo to the combat wings out there, basically saying, send me people of color, send me women. Now, does that sound like a meritocracy, or does that sound like somebody trying to follow the diversity roadmap? I think it's the latter.
Well, it is. And this is what's so worrying, Rowan Scarborough, as you understand and report on so well. This is an institution which has achieved its extraordinary successes and enjoyed the very strong appreciation of the American people for years because it is a meritocracy. It does what it does well because the best people do it. It's worrying in the extreme what this legacy is, and I hope you're right that Barack Obama will, in some form or fashion by history, be held accountable for it. Not the American people, not the men and women who may be put in very difficult circumstances because of this craziness. Hey, Rowan, let me ask you about something else. As I mentioned, you've written a book on sabotage, America's enemies within the CIA. You've been reporting lately about evidence that I believe it was Defense Intelligence Agency, but perhaps intelligence more generally, was doctored to support the Obama administration meme that it was making great progress in taking down the Islamic State. Remind us about the background to this story and what the latest has been on it.
Yes. Well, the two whistleblowers in 2015 complained to the Defense Intelligence Agency that at Central Command, which is fighting the wars in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, the Persian Gulf, that the higher-ups in the J-2, or the intelligence unit, were massaging intelligence reports to make the war in Iraq look better than it actually was. And why this is important is the J-2 reports directly to the Director of National Intelligence several times a week. Because that command is so important, the DNI then reports to the president every day. So as you can see, the J-2 at CENTCOM at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa is probably more important than any other J-2 in the world. Now, the whistleblower's complaint ended up in the lap of the Pentagon Inspector General, and they seem to have done a very thorough investigation based on my reading of the report. And what they found was, yes, there were some reports where things were changed to make them look better, like an ISIL assault on an airbase, which actually was successful, was changed in the final intel report to read unsuccessful. And this is one of the things that prompted the whistleblowers. The bottom line, however, is that the IG could not say that the higher-ups deliberately falsified intelligence reports. That was their level. You know, if it didn't cross that line, then they decided that would be the conclusion in the report. So, but if you read the full report, you can see that stuff was massaged on occasion and tweaked to make it look better.
Yeah, a worrying thing, politicization of intelligence, needless to say. Let me ask you very quickly, we've got less than a minute, Rowan Scarborough. There is a commitment from the President of the United States to rebuild the United States military, to restore it to a posture of peace through strength. You've described how seriously short of the mark it is at the moment. Do you anticipate those resources necessary to rebuild it will be forthcoming?
I think Trump's first budget is going to have a big boost in defense, without a doubt. You know, he was at Central Command and Special Operations Command on Monday, and in his talk, he promised to the troops in the audience that you're going to get new equipment, as he put it. And new equipment, I think, is going to be more planes, more vehicles, things that will keep the Army brigades ready to go, and things that will take Navy aviation into this decade.
Yeah, what a concept. Rowan, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we look forward to visiting with you often in the course of 2017. Thank you so much for your time today and the great work you do at The Washington Times. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.